Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, some small businesses in the Valley are pivoting their business models in reaction to the pandemic. And we share a conversation about friendship from StoryCorps San Joaquin. But first, as COVID-19 cases continue to increase in the Valley, FM89's Madi Bolaños reports one Fresno organization is working around the clock to translate information related to the virus for Arab and Hmong speakers.
Naveen Al-Assad sits at her dining table in Fresno talking with three of her six children. Conversations like these are often a mix of Arabic and English, and on this night, the topic ranges from online school to the pandemic. Al-Assad and her husband Nassar are originally from Syria. They came to Fresno in 2016 as refugees. It's been challenging enough coming to a new country, finding work, making doctor's appointments, getting the kids into schools, and the pandemic has only made it harder. Naveen says she's relied on one organization, Fresno Interdenominational Refugee Ministries, for help.
We kept updated through those short video clips that has case confirmed regarding what's COVID-19, what's happening, what are the symptoms, what should you go.
She says if it weren't for FIRM, understanding the pandemic would be a lot more complicated.
The other option, it could be like asking the doctor or go some searches through Google, but that wouldn't offer it to me but with my language. So in this case, I would need the help of my kids who are already at the school.
But Dalia Hussein, who works at FIRM and is translating for Naveen, says it's a struggle for Arab children to navigate cultural differences, let alone become translators for information on a new virus.
Because of the barrier of the language, families of the community couldn't understand it perfectly, what's going on.
FIRM holds weekly meetings where about 23 translators, including Hussein, meet with medical advisors to discuss questions their communities have concerning the coronavirus.
You get the answers, we translate it and transfer it to the community.
They do this by distributing pamphlets in other languages, including Arabic. And they even produce short informational videos to share via text messages, Hussein says.
I noticed myself adding a lot of phone numbers, names for families that I'm sending messages or videos.
The Syrian community is relatively new to the Fresno area, and it's pretty tight-knit. So when the pandemic hit, Hussein says social distancing was really hard for some people to embrace.
Culturally, the Arab community, they love to gather all the time, like families, friends. So it wasn't that easy job to explain, not to go to your parents' house, not to go to your neighbor, not to go to your brother's house.
But it's not just the Syrian community FIRM is assisting. The organization also partners with KBIF Hmong Radio four times a month to provide information on COVID-19. Most of the translators on the station are women, and on this broadcast, Pei Yang Her is talking about where testing sites are located. Elijah Her is also a translator for FIRM. He says it's important that the younger generation share information about the virus in Hmong because the older community tends to trust them.
So as soon as one family member explains to them what the virus and how it could affect them and how it could affect other family members around them, it gets them to think that, you know, they need to listen and do what needs to be done to protect themselves and their family.
Her says having professional translations lifts the burden off of younger generations who may already struggle to keep up with different Hmong dialects, especially with a new virus that isn't even a part of the Hmong vocabulary.
In Hmong, there's no language for a virus. It's all bacteria. So we have to explain basically what a virus is in detail of how we would put a virus in Hmong to the community.
It's why pamphlets and radio shows are so vital, he says. The translation of health information plays a critical role in this global crisis. Dalia Hussein agrees.
You are serving people to survive, honestly, survive, because they don't know where to go. They don't know anything about the language, and they could do a lot of mistakes.
And now with schools moving to online learning due to the pandemic, both say they're shifting their focus to translating documents for parents and ensuring kids get access to the devices and hotspots they'll need to start the school year. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Maddie Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As businesses throughout the Valley struggle as a result of COVID-19, many small businesses and entrepreneurs are turning to their local Small Business Development Centers, or SBDCs, for help accessing capital and reimagining their business models. I spoke with Rich Mostert, director of the Valley Community SBDC, and Kelly Bearden, director of the CSU Bakersfield SBDC, about how small businesses in the Valley are meeting this moment.
Rich, I'd like to start with you. Can you put into perspective how important small businesses are to the regional economy?
Well, they're important to both the regional and the state and the national economy. We've all heard the statistics that the vast majority of jobs created are created by small businesses. And so understand that, you know, whether it's on a macro level or a micro level, small businesses are the lifeblood of any community. And it is imperative that we do everything in our power during these very trying times to try to help them survive and actually grow and prosper into the future, because they're going to be the answer to our economic troubles down the road.
So what are you hearing for businesses?
Well, you know, it really is a combination of a lot of things. You know, I would hope to not focus on too much of the gloom and doom, but there are some businesses that are really struggling and working hard to maintain their business during these times. And a lot of it is related to their industry type or to conditions affecting their industry type. What we're hoping we can do is help existing businesses maintain their operations, but also work with businesses that are struggling to pivot and try to find different ways to stay in business and maybe alternative strategies or markets to pursue in order to do something different but maintain their traditional business model.
Kelly, maybe you could elaborate on that. What are some examples of ways in which businesses are pivoting or changing their business models to adapt to this moment?
Well, obviously you're seeing it first and foremost with restaurants and dine-in establishments that have been so severely impacted. You see them offering takeout meals, takeout, patio dining, and other things. But it's transitioning just beyond the obvious that you see. So many are looking for new customers. They're looking for different customers. If their customer base is gone for a while, hopefully they can shift maybe some retail portions online. So you're seeing a lot of creativity, and you're seeing a lot of opportunity in the midst of, you know, unprecedented crisis.
I understand that in Kern County, the Kern Recovers, the county's coronavirus relief loan program, is now out of funds. Can you speak to what other resources there are for small businesses in terms of keeping them afloat in these really unprecedented times?
Yeah, the Kern Recovers program was an excellent $25 million program. And it really did a very good job of filling in the blanks for when your federal program, your PPP, your payroll protection program, where it kind of left some people out. For example, the Kern Recovers program, the average loan size made was only $29,000. And on the PPP, it was over $100,000. So it kind of reached down to the smaller businesses in the outlying communities, and they learned some of the things that were different. And there is a potential, you know, in talking with some of the county leaders that they could come back with more funding later, but it is true the $25 million is gone. But they still offer the PPE program for personal protection equipment. And that is continuing as the virus is really kind of surging recently. That's more important than ever to provide that PPE with small businesses. So that is really a very valuable program to those that have customers and also employees that are in contact with the public. Another program that we're really using, and I know Rich has been really one of the leaders in the Valley with this, is the SBA disaster program, the Economic Injury Disaster Program, or the EIDL. And that is the program that is continuing. It's open. It's a little harder to qualify than some of the other payroll-based programs. There are, you have to demonstrate a need that you have a need for that and need working capital for your business. And the loans right now are up to $150,000, and we're seeing them funded very quickly. Were there people that actually told me yesterday that they applied last week, and 2 days later they got approved, and 2 days later they received the funds. And really, as the crisis has come on, you've really heard a lot about the PPP program, but really the low interest rate of 3.75% over 30 years, the EIDL program is really the tool that really can really carry a business for a sustained period of time now that we're through this initial and we're starting to see more closures and more problems down the road.
Rich, maybe you could elaborate on this a bit more. You know, I have heard some examples of businesses that have been able to access capital quite easily, but I've also heard a lot of horror stories and businesses that have just been inundated with red tape and have not been able to access the loans that they needed. Can you give us a sense of what that process has been like for some of the businesses that you work with?
Well, overall, I have to make a preemptive statement and just say that I don't think any of that is intentional. I think a lot of it is a function of the fact that programs were created extremely fast and launched very quickly, and they were a learning process for pretty much every party involved. But one of the issues that we see is that the programs we're talking about, EIDL and PPP, are loan programs where there are qualification criteria and underwriting requirements, where it's not as easy as it sounds in terms of actually applying and then getting the loan. What I have seen the most of are businesses that have applied and the timing takes much longer than they expected, and that's been a more of a serious issue. Most of the applications we've had, probably more than 85%, have actually applied and been approved. So we're not seeing a dramatic amount of declinations due to credit issues or underwriting criteria. We're seeing the problems arise from the delay in getting the funds. And as Kelly alluded to earlier, now that we've had a rebirth of the program under EIDL again, it is moving a lot faster. So we're seeing fewer problems there.
So this is an impossible question to answer, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. And Kelly, I'm going to start with you. You know, we don't know what the future holds. We don't know how long it's going to be until our economy goes back to what it once was, or when businesses can operate as they used to. But when that moment comes, I mean, what do you think recovery will look like?
Well, that is a very impossible question to answer. But, you know, what we're recommending individuals do is to take a long-term approach, and it's almost by industry, because there are businesses that continue to thrive and continue to do well. And there are those, by the very nature of larger gatherings and groups and events and a lot of different industries, particularly hospitality, travel, et cetera, that are going to struggle, and they're going to struggle over a longer period of time. But what we're really trying to do is we're really trying to get people to focus on conserving the cash that they have and the resources they have to survive the crisis and to continue to keep yourself in play and to adjust and work your cash flow and work on budget and do all the things that you need to do in your personal lifestyle and your business to sustain it, particularly if you had a very profitable business model to begin with. There's no saying that you can't get back there. We don't know when it's going to be. It could be after there's a vaccine for many businesses. And that could be a longer term problem of trying to survive while you struggle. And really, we're going to see that coming right now. We're going to see the cash flow issues that start happening and the customers slow to come back. So whereas I can't give you, you know, there's been, as far as some of the failures that you're talking about, as far as statistics go, some of those kind of range from as high as, like, in the restaurant industry, from OpenTable, who's saying potentially 30% of restaurants are going to close, to more recently, we've been seeing numbers somewhere around 10%. So I think right now it's just kind of wild speculation. And I think the advice that I'm giving and Rich is giving is going to be to try to conserve that cash and do what you can to retain your customers that you have, and just prepare for a longer period of time to where it's not going to be business as usual.
Rich, are there any other tips or strategies that you are sharing with businesses?
Well, and again, I think Kelly summarized it really well, but I have to say, I think most small business owners are very intelligent people, and they're recognizing that this is not a one and done situation, and that what they have to do is not only adapt and conserve and really thoroughly manage their cash flow, but they also have to look at where does their business go in the future, and what to plan for in the event of another pandemic. What can they do to prevent the problems of shutdowns and or changes in structure, physical or operational, that they have to accommodate? And I'm hoping we can see an evolution of traditional business structures and say, okay, this is our model, and going forward, this should help us at least try to mitigate some of the negative impacts we've received right now. This is unfortunately one of the most painful but very strong learning processes we've all been through in the last, well, in my history in business. So we're hoping to take that, the information we're getting now, and use it to build stronger businesses moving forward, fix the ones that it can survive. And we're working diligently, Kelly and I, to try to get new business startups that are as pandemic proof as they could possibly be, given the stance.
And what does that look like?
Well, it could be how they're physically structured in terms of how they accept clients or deliver products or services. It could be the way they package and present their services. It could be the markets they send to, they deliver to. They may not have an on-site customer base anymore. They may be all virtual or through online platforms. So it really just depends, and we're learning as we go to try to find the best models for people to survive.
Well, I think that's true of everyone. We're figuring this out in real time as we move through this pandemic. So I just want to thank you both for being on the show and for all the work that you're doing to keep these vital and essential small businesses successful and alive in these very strange times. So thank you both.
Well, thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, I also checked in with a couple of local businesses, one that's been operational for 18 years and another for just a few weeks. First, you'll hear from Katie Flynn, owner of Coil Yoga in Fresno. When in-person classes ended in March, she switched to online and in May permanently closed her Fresno studio. She started our conversation by talking about that difficult decision.
It was like saying goodbye to your kid when they go to college, or what I might imagine that grief and fear would feel like. I don't think any parent is ever ready to release their children out into the world. And I've always treated my business like it's a human being and been very mindful of who I surround her with, and been so proud of the community that we've attracted in the 18 years. And so that decision to let that space go was really for the overall health and well-being of myself, my family, and my community. I had a very strong gut feeling that we as a society were going to be on this roller coaster of opening and closing for quite some time. And I couldn't foresee opening in the summer and then maybe having to close up again. And ethically, I just did not feel like it was going to be safe anytime soon to invite people into a practice space and have them connect with their breath and release their fears amidst a world where there's so many things that are unknown right now. What we know is what we don't know. And since that decision was made to close the physical location, I've, you know, just really kind of adjusted to teaching online and getting creative with how to stay connected with my students visually, no more hands-on adjustments. So it's an evolving process and trying to figure out how to meet people's needs and go with the crazy flow of what we're in.
You know, I'm glad you brought up teaching live classes because I think it speaks to the value that yoga studios, businesses like that provide, which is community. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, how are you fostering that sense of community at a time when it's probably needed most?
Well, luckily, we've had such a strong community previous to the shutdown that, you know, those people that were able to stay online and committed to their practice and their routines are still there. I think of my Tuesday night group. I think some of these people I've had coming for over 10 years. And we just keep talking about that moment when we get to see each other in person and at least give an air high five and eventually, you know, to hug each other. And we check in and we keep track, like, where is so-and-so? And you know, people have shared loss. One of my students, her mom, passed away from COVID, and she said to the group, hey guys, you know, this is a real thing. Put your masks on, you know, and it kind of gave people, this was a month or so ago, things weren't as bad as they are now. And, you know, people were like, oh, I don't need to wear a mask. And, you know, so there's been some real moments. There's been tears and we laugh. And my other teachers that are still teaching are fostering that connection as well. We save time at the end of the class to talk to each other. And I sign on 30 minutes before, and I'm there if people want to check in and just, you know, talk individually. And so that's how I'm doing it now. And so I'm reminding people that yoga is an inward experience, and ideally people develop a home practice. And what great tools to learn how to be in your home with your kids yelling and the dog barking. And how do you maintain your cool when you're in the real life nitty gritty? And people are figuring out how to do that, setting boundaries, putting a sign on the door, mom's yoga time, dad's yoga time. So I see some bronze linings in all this. I'm going with bronze because I feel like silver's overrated. Everyone's talking about that silver lining. I'm like, I don't know. I got to look real hard for that one.
So what about loans? Have you had success in accessing some of the capital that has been made available to help businesses like yours?
I have received one, and I'm not even accessing all of it because there's so many crazy stipulations. I will just say financially, I took a huge hit closing the studio, number one, and then having to negotiate with my landlords and, let's just say, invest in getting out of that lease, which was not an easy task. And, you know, I'm not in a position where I can just offer free yoga. I wish I could, you know, I wish I could just say, I'm sitting pretty, everything's good. I'm going to just spend all my time offering all these free classes online. But I really believe that, you know, there's something out for everybody out there, and I've discounted my pricing, and I'm going to continue to do another pricing discount just to try to stay competitive with studios that are going cheaper and cheaper and cheaper because they have to. But I have been doing this a long time. I am an excellent yoga teacher, and I'm not just saying that to toot my own horn. I've done tons of education and training and just spent time, you know, in the trenches of my own life, like cultivating this and what I have to offer has value, and we all have to kind of find ways to support each other in adding value to our lives right now.
That was Katie Flynn, owner of Coil Yoga in Fresno. Next, you'll hear from brothers Matt and Bob Ainley, co-owners of the Darling Hotel, which opened in downtown Visalia on July 1st. Matt starts by sharing what it's been like to start a business at such a volatile time.
The good thing is that it forces you to really stay pretty lean and aggressive and, you know, make sure that your business model is going to work. And if you can make it through this, then a lot of times you're set up for pretty well for the future. But yeah, it's definitely challenging. And we were definitely having to really, you know, react and try to respond to stay ahead of things and do whatever we can to get people to still, you know, feel good and come to stay at the hotel. The restaurant hasn't been it's been challenging to stay ahead of, but it has a lot of outdoor seating. And so luckily we've been able to keep that mostly operational. It's not without its challenges and all that, but yeah, it's definitely tougher now.
Bob, maybe you could elaborate a little bit more about how your business model has adapted to the world that we're living in right now.
Well, I mean, just from kind of the obvious best practices that we've had to take on, you know, I know that staff are not particularly excited about wearing masks everywhere they go. So, you know, kind of just those challenges. But also on the end of, for example, the hotel has had to shift its target demographic away from what we thought it was going to be. The foreign travelers and the business travelers that come through the South Valley, which most people don't realize is actually pretty high. It's pretty robust. I mean, that's why we actually chose the hotel model to begin with, and shifting it more towards local interest and even coastal interest in just trying to get away for the staycation type model or getting as far of a vacation as they can right now.
Well, Matt, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the hotel itself.
You know, it's an adaptive reuse of an exceptional historic structure. It's very cool old 1930s LA Art Deco that had been abandoned for the last decade or so by the county. And so the hotel came out, you know, I really feel like it's a great mix of the Central Valley, and you still, you know, like I have a lot of people that come in and they say, hey, if they didn't even know where they had parked and where they were at, they would think that they were at a little upscale boutique hotel in Hollywood or in LA. It really does have, you know, a feel and an ambiance of something unique and special and just something that you're not going to get, especially around, you know, in the Central Valley, really.
So, right. So the hotel opened the same day that the governor shut indoor dining down for many, for many counties, including Tulare County. So, but you know, you've been open for a couple weeks now. What kind of feedback are you getting from folks?
Yeah, people are really enjoying it. Like you said, you know, the day that we opened, I think within that 24-hour period, we had 54 room cancellations, you know, in that same day. So it definitely impacts, even though we're still open, it's just, you know, the perception still impacts. So everyone that has been coming, and I actually feel like we've been gaining some momentum, even as the last week or two have gone on. It's a lot of local couples and families, and they come out pretty blown away.
Well, Matt and Bob, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the Darling.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, California hit a grim milestone. It now has the highest number of COVID-19 cases of any state in the country. Hospitalizations and ICU rates continue to rise. Here to put a local spotlight on these numbers is FM89's Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Carrie, welcome back.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
So give us a summary of what's happened in the Valley this week.
Okay, so these are grim milestones indeed. As you said, we have the most cases of any state. Of course, we also have the highest population of any state. And when you actually look at the per capita rates of the disease, other states are still faring much worse than California is, like New York and Florida. In the Valley, in the last week, another milestone, the disease has hit 1% of our population. One out of every 100 people has tested positive. And the CDC, of course, has indicated that the positivity rate is likely much higher than that. And I also wanted to add a couple notes about testing. Tests have been backlogged across the state. It takes a long time to schedule a test, even longer to get your results back. I touched on this briefly last week, but to try to alleviate these backlogs, the state is really prioritizing people with symptoms right now, or those who work in high-risk sectors and may have been exposed. And of course, if you do ever have questions, contact your doctor or county health official, but those groups of people are getting priority for testing. And also on that note, if you've tested positive, the state and county do not require you to get a second negative test in order to go back to work. This is a really common misconception out there. The county is very much discouraging workplaces from requiring this negative test, again, because of this backlog. The current guidelines now from the CDC, they've changed recently, are that you're required to quarantine 10 days after a positive test, plus one day after your symptoms are gone, and then you're considered recovered without needing another test.
That's so interesting. I had no idea. Thank you for that. So let's switch gears. As usual, I'd love it if you could walk us through some highlights this week from all of the counties in our region.
Okay, so let's start with Fresno. There's an update on the outbreak in the county jail. The case count there is up to more than 700 cases as of earlier this week. That includes 40 staff. That means roughly a third of all people in the county jail tested positive and 10% of staff. And for now, inmates are still being quarantined according to their testing status. In Kern County, they are back on the state monitoring list. They had been off for a couple of weeks. So that means that the most recent round of closures, things like gyms, places of worship, personal hygiene, like salons and waxing centers, tattoos. The closures of those businesses will apply soon, if not this morning, while the show is running. Also, next Tuesday, the county will be bringing an interesting proposal to the Board of Supervisors to bring in more nurses. The plan proposes using federal CARES Act money to hire 84 ICU nurses who'd be distributed among county hospitals. All right, Kings County, there's been an additional drive-through testing site added in Hanford. It's at the site of Alma's Flea Market. You can find out more from the Kings County Public Health website. In Madera, county health officials there held their first info session this week on COVID-19 since March, and they spent most of it answering residents' questions, a lot about masks and testing in schools. It's a good place to go for a lot of basic information. You can find it on the County Public Health Department's Facebook page. Again, that was Madera County. Now, if we go to Merced, UC Merced has joined the ranks of schools starting their year online. They haven't made a decision about an entire quarter or semester yet, but the first 4 weeks starting in August will all be online. In Tulare County, more county offices are closing. We've been reporting on that these last few weeks. And this week, it's a Tulare Works office in Dinuba and Child Support Service offices in Visalia and Porterville. These offices are just closing temporarily, so check back on their website for when they may reopen. And then lastly, Mariposa, again, case counts there are rising, but only very slowly. And the county health officials have introduced a new data dashboard where you can see lots of different data elements online.
That's great. Now let's continue our discussion of local hospitals and what they're doing to keep up with capacity issues as COVID cases surge. In the past few weeks, we've heard from administrators at Kern Medical, Valley Children's, and Cahuilla Delta. Who did you speak to this week?
So this week, it was St. Agnes Medical Center, the second largest hospital in Fresno, and I spoke with Gene Egerton, the chief medical officer. He echoes what I've been hearing from other hospitals in this area. They're inundated right now, not just COVID patients, but patients in general, and capacity is becoming a concern.
We're not at our licensed bed capacity, which is 436. But we are for the staffed beds that we have pretty much full.
Though he says they do have space for COVID patients at the moment and for those coming in for necessary procedures like surgeries.
So what are they doing to prepare for a surge?
Well, they're already implementing their surge protocol, he says, and also that goes for a lot of hospitals. And that protocol includes setting up tents in their parking lot. There's one for evaluating patients, the other for isolating patients while they await test results. That's because hospitals have some fast return tests for patients who show up at the emergency room. But their plan also includes setting up an isolated respiratory unit. Here's more from Egerton.
That pretty much consists of rooms that we isolate. We turn those rooms into negative airflow rooms because COVID patients require that type of airborne isolation environment. We actually have converted two floors in the north wing of our facility into COVID-only floors, which gives us the capacity to take care of patients in a completely isolated environment that also contains an ICU capacity.
He mentioned the term negative airflow room. What does that mean?
So this is actually a pretty common setup in hospitals when you have infectious patients. The airflow is in a particular room is basically set to a vacuum. I mean, not strong enough that it's actually sucking anything up, but strong enough that it won't let air out of a room. So that keeps any aerosols or airborne particles or droplets from getting out of the room to infect anyone else.
That's so interesting. I mean, of course, hospitals need to plan not just for taking care of COVID patients, but also for keeping other patients COVID-free. How else can hospitals keep other patients safe?
Well, as Egerton told me, they've dedicated two floors of a particular wing to COVID, and that keeps those patients from mingling with others. A lot of hospitals are making arrangements like that, kind of setting up pods or units specifically for COVID. But in their surge plans, hospitals are also mapping out entry and exit routes so that patients and staff don't get any more exposure to COVID patients than necessary.
We cover a lot of ground in these weekly interviews, but there is so much more out there. Where would you suggest people go to get the information they need?
Yeah, I mean, I think there really is a thirst for basic knowledge out there, especially because so much of the basic information has been changing so rapidly in all this. So, you know, one really easy place to go is local health departments. Every county has one. They're really putting in an effort to put information out on their websites. Fresno County holds media calls 3 times per week. Kern County has one every Thursday. Madera County just held one this week. And then also lots of hospitals are offering information on their websites. Valley Children's held a town hall this week. Next week, Cahuilla Delta will. Get in touch with county officials, check out websites, get on mailing lists. There are really a lot of places where you can go to get the information you need.
Well, Carrie, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. One of the cornerstones of the COVID-19 response is contact tracing, when teams of people get in touch with workplaces and close contacts of people who have tested positive. Governor Gavin Newsom has required every county health department to take on 15 contact tracers for every 100,000 residents. But are counties following through? An article published last week in the policy outlet CalMatters says no, specifically Merced County. FM89's health reporter Carrie Klein spoke with the article's author, Rebecca Sohn, to learn more.
So we contacted, I think, 27 counties. 21 got back to us. And out of all of those counties, Merced was the only one who told us that they weren't doing contact tracing. So they weren't reaching out to any close contact of people, and they also weren't attempting to do that. So I think there's definitely a difference between a county that's sort of struggling based on, you know, how many contact tracers they actually have and what's realistic, based on a county like Merced, who just is not trying at this point to reach out to anyone.
Right. Okay. So they confirmed that when you submitted a Public Records Act request to all of these counties.
I actually didn't. So
weren't Public Records Act requests. Okay.
Yeah. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify. I sent them an email, as I did with many other counties, and they responded that they would prefer to have me talk on the phone with someone. So I talked on the phone with Kristen Sullivan, who is their county supervising epidemiologist, and she told me that they didn't have the ability to do contact tracing and that they felt that at this point, contact tracing was ineffective because the outbreak was not contained and so many people had been exposed, so they weren't attempting to do contact tracing. And I didn't That was a unique response. I didn't get that sort of response from any other county, that they had completely given up.
Right. So you confirmed this through emailing with the county and a conversation, and you had this epidemiologist on the record saying that contact tracing is not happening or is no longer happening in Merced County.
Absolutely. Yeah. She said that numerous times. And I called her again. I had another interview with her, and I also had a third interview with her to sort of confirm that information. And sometimes she would call what they were doing minimal contact tracing, but all of the information was confirmed through these multiple interviews. She was very transparent, and I felt it was pretty clear that they weren't doing contact tracing as most people would understand contact tracing.
Right. Okay, well, we can talk more about the difference between minimal contact tracing and maybe the more formal definition of it. I'll come back to that a little bit later. But I also want to talk about the other folks that you spoke to for this story. In particular, you had spoken with a man named Hugo Garcia. He works at an almond processing plant, has a really tragic story. Tell me about his story and what that means about not having contact tracing.
Right. So first, I want to clarify that I didn't actually speak to Hugo Garcia. A reporter named Nadia Lopez, who contributed to the story, actually interviewed him. And mm-hmm. she's a reporter at the Fresno Bee.
Right.
And I'm very thankful for her for contributing great community reporting. She did a great job. So he works at an almond processing plant, as you said, and his plant, basically everyone ended up getting infected with the virus. And he did as well, but the plant was eventually closed, but they sort of waited until everyone was infected to sort of close it. And his employer did know that people were coming down with the virus, but told them to sort of carry on anyway. And he ended up giving the virus to his mother, unfortunately, who ended up passing away. And I think that that kind of situation is what would be avoided if true contact tracing was happening, because a public health official could have called him and told him, hey, please quarantine. And also everyone else in the plant would have been told as soon as they've been exposed, instead of being told by their employer, hey, you've been exposed, but keep working.
And so Garcia himself claims that the county never asked him where he works or who else he'd come into contact with while he was infectious.
Right. Yes. He says that they never asked him any questions besides briefly asking him about his symptoms. But he says that they never asked him about where he works, who he came into contact with, his family members, anything like that. He says they didn't ask him any questions like that.
Right. Okay. So you have these people corroborating this fact that there's no contact tracing there. You have Garcia and then also this county epidemiologist. And yet the county has officially disagreed with your reporting, correct? Tell me about the county's response to the story.
Yeah. So after the story was published, I believe they sent out a press release on Friday saying that the story misrepresented, I think that's the word they use, information about contact tracing, and that they sort of listed various points that they were calling people, that they were helping them identify their contacts, that they were informing employers. They actually didn't say that they are informing close contacts because they're not. When we followed up with them, they also confirmed this. So I think that what it comes down to is they say what they're doing counts as contact tracing. And according to the CDC and to many different epidemiologists, it doesn't.
Right. Tell me more about that. So especially since you said that, you know, they at one point referred to this as minimal contact tracing, you know, if that is the case, or even if it's zero contact tracing, what is the difference between that and what the CDC calls for?
The CDC says in their requirements that public health staff begin contact tracing by warning those exposed individuals of their potential exposure as rapidly and sensitively as possible. And the CDC also specifies that that is one of the core principles of contact tracing and case investigation that must always be adhered to. They have this list of principles that have to be adhered to for it to be true contact tracing. And that is one of them. And they're not adhering to that principle.
And so as you report on this, on contact tracing efforts in general, I mean, what is the overall importance of this part of the COVID-19 response? I mean, we've been hearing from many counties, even those who have hired the number of tracers that are required by the governor, that they're just struggling to keep up with all of these rising positive cases. Is it still a relevant tool in fighting the virus?
Well, I definitely think it's true that, you know, as many epidemiologists I've spoken to have said, like, contact tracing is a really valuable tool, but it's also one that has not historically been utilized at the numbers that we're seeing with COVID-19. So I definitely recognize that it is really challenging to, you know, do this contact tracing, especially if, you know, the initial interview takes half an hour to 45 minutes, and then the follow-up with each contact takes an hour or maybe more. You know, I recognize that it's really resource intensive, but I think that, you know, according to every expert I've spoken to, contact tracing is really a crucial tool to, you know, help combat this pandemic. You know, we don't have a vaccine. We don't have a lot of concrete medical treatments. So our best chance at reducing numbers of this virus is testing, tracing, and containing outbreaks. And that's all we can do. So yes, I do think that it is still extremely effective. And I also will say that I think there's a difference between, as I said, counties who are struggling to keep up, which I think is definitely a valid problem and one that's completely understandable, and then counties like Merced who have just given up trying to do contact tracing, not even doing it on some people, just determining that it's not useful anymore when public health knowledge really doesn't back up that claim.
Okay, Rebecca Sohn of Cal Matters, thank you so much for speaking with me, and good luck with the rest of your reporting.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And now it's time for StoryCorps San Joaquin. As part of Valley Public Radio's collaboration with the Personal History Project, we'll be airing segments over the next year based on recorded conversations from the 2020 mobile tour in Fresno and Bakersfield. Today you'll hear from two religious leaders in Fresno, Rabbi Rick Weiner of Temple Beth Israel and Reza Nigumanish, Executive Director of the Islamic Cultural Center. They talk about the value of Fresno's interfaith community, social activism, and most especially, their friendship. Rabbi Rick Weiner starts.
The image that always comes back to me in my decision to pursue professional religious life is always the image of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. You know, I was going to go
there. I knew that's where you were going to go, man.
Well, and it's so timely.
That's right.
Marching alongside of Martin Luther King in Selma, and, you know, they just were at the Edmund Pettus Bridge again with John Lewis in the midst of battling pancreatic cancer, was out there again.
And what's the quote? When I was marching, my feet were praying.
Right. So, you know, Rabbi Heschel was chided for coming down from his ivory tower of he was a thinker and professor and theologian, and they said, why do you come down from your ivory tower to march with Dr. King? And he said, when I'm marching with Dr. King, my feet are praying.
I've always cared about doing social justice work. I've always cared about bringing about awareness. But like many other people that are boxed into a religious tradition, for me, I only did social justice work in the guise of what's the best for the Muslim community. That's where I was a long time ago. I thought, you know, I want to fight for Muslims. I want to stand up for Muslims. The Muslim community is under attack. And then it was, I don't remember when my shift began, or when I can't look at the point and say this is where I changed, but all of it changed through relationships. All of it changed through relationships. So while I didn't hate Jewish people, I didn't start really caring about Jewish people until I had Jewish friends. It's about all the different times that I sat with people and did good work or revolutionary work or love work. And we were different faiths coming together, it makes a huge difference. So now when something happens to the Jewish community, a terrible thing happens, for me, like, I'm immediately thinking, what's up with my brothers, my sisters, my comrade? What's up with them? Like, what do they need?
You know, you were alluding to the service that we had after the synagogue was attacked in Pittsburgh, which was one of the most powerful moments of my life, the way people came together for that. And I had
very last minute, like while it was happening, I was making the decision to, I knew I wanted to read from our Holocaust Torah scroll, and I knew I wanted it held up so everyone could see it. And I decided, knowing that I might take flack, that I would have my brothers, you, and our brother DJ, the Black Baptist preacher, hold up the scroll. Not one negative comment.
Oh, nice.
It was the opposite. I mean, that was when people lost it, when people were crying. Wow. And knew that it was powerful. So where it's most important, the community has been outstanding. And I always feel that when I walk into the Islamic Center, yeah. when I am so warmly welcomed there. You know, most of our world that you and I deal with is Christian, and it's really nice to have that commonality. I mean, who would know that that for me, a Jew, having a Muslim to, I want to say party with, but that's not the word we're looking for, the in between to engage with, but it's so much more fun than that. Yeah. And for you, I think the same way. You know, there are times where it's you and I against the world. For the world.
Yeah, and in so many settings that you're not in, like, it's like one of my bragging points. Like, you know, like one of my very close buddies is the rabbi. And I'm like, huh? Really? How does that happen? And I'm like, well, because we're human beings and we look at each other as dignified individuals that have the right to live and love and work. And so... definitely. When you care about somebody and when you believe that you have you want to make a big change, that when you're out there fighting, whatever you're fighting.
Absolutely.
And when you have disagreements, you come and you talk.
And I would say even on the Israel-Palestine issue, we're far more aligned than most people are.
Absolutely. I don't think people could realize that.
In Hebrew, there's a term tzimtzum, which means to withdraw. Which in today's world means withdrawing your own ego, withdrawing your own issues in order to make room for others. And when we do that, it's just so much more gratifying.
Could we translate that today, just like, say, put out more folding chairs? Huh? Make some space at the table for everybody?
Yeah, or stand arm in arm.
Stand arm in arm, like you started today. Stand arm in arm and be together, love together, fight together, or march through the Capitol. Whatever it takes, just be arm in arm and finding power in that.
Well, I'm going with a bit of a formula. May the one who creates peace in the heavens above us bring peace upon the earth for all of us.
Oh, there's nothing I can say after that. Amen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.